I'm Marty Moscoane. Welcome to Radio Times. Severe mental illnesses like schizophrenia and bipolar disorder, as well as drug and alcohol dependency, are considered diseases requiring a variety of mental health services. But increasingly, prisons and jails have become modern-day mental institutions because of the increasing number of people behind bars who have some form of mental illness. Problem is, they are not getting the treatment they need. A new program, the Stepping Up Initiative, is focusing on the nation's jails to reduce the number of mentally ill prisoners and to get them the appropriate care. The campaign is supported by law enforcement and mental health associations, and it's being instituted by a number of Pennsylvania counties as well as counties in other states. Today on Radio Times, the mental health needs of the incarcerated. Joining us is John Wetzel, Secretary of Corrections for Pennsylvania. And John Wetzel, nice to have you back with us on Radio Times.
Yeah, it's good to be here. Thanks.
You're welcome. Also with us is Fred Osher, and he's Director of Health Systems and Services Policy at the Council of State Governments Justice Center Initiatives. That's a mouthful. And this is a group that is leading this initiative. And Fred Osher, nice to have you with us on Radio Times as well.
Thank you, Marty.
Also with us and joining us here in our Philadelphia studio is Bruce Herdman, and he's Chief of Medical Operations for the Philadelphia Department of Prisons. He also sits on WHYY's Community Advisory Board. And Bruce Herdman, nice to have you with us on Radio Times as well.
Thank you. Good morning.
Good morning to all three of you. John Wetzel, let me begin with you, and then I want to hear from you, Bruce, and then Fred will get you in on the conversation as well. John, when you look at the number of people incarcerated in Pennsylvania, how many would you say have some form of mental illness?
29% are on our mental health roster. Actually, 71% of our female population is on the mental health roster. So, and we're talking about 29% of nearly 49,000, so significant numbers.
Has that number been increasing? Because I know we've been reducing our prison population. Are these numbers going up?
Yeah, the percentage-wise, it's certainly going up. And it seems like this is an issue, Marty, you and I talk about yearly, the significant increase in individuals with mental illness coming through the criminal justice system. At the county level, it's much more acute than even at the state level.
Well, let me get you, Bruce Herdman, in on the conversation. Let's talk about this county, Philadelphia County. How many people would you say in prisons, jails in Philadelphia have some form of mental illness?
Overall, the 40% of the citizens that are in the jail are on the mental health caseload. Virtually all of those are medicated. Half of them have serious chronic mental illnesses such as schizophrenia and bipolar disease. For the female population, it's 60% and 28%.
Why is John, let me go back to you, but also to you, Bruce. Why more women with mental illness who are incarcerated? John?
Yeah, I can't tell you. It's something we just started studying, but it's a phenomenon that my colleagues around the country all are experiencing, and perhaps Fred, who travels all over the country doing this, would have a better perspective than I would on it.
Well, let's get you in on the conversation, Fred Osher. Why more women?
Yeah, and the stats that you're hearing from Pennsylvania are replicated across the country, and that it's stunning that those women booked into our correctional facilities have such a high degree of mental illness. We know that rates of trauma in the female population, close to 95%, that oftentimes create situations in which they have unstable housing, inability to create the resources necessary to stay in the community, frequently find themselves as part of criminal activity. And the pathways in for women are varied, but nonetheless that figure is staggering, and it demands a response that's gender sensitive. And I think that many facilities around the country are implementing those programs.
Fred, both John Wetzel and Bruce Herdman have described either Philadelphia or Pennsylvania prisons and jails as modern-day mental institutions. Is that pretty true across the country?
Well, it's true that in absolute and relative terms, the number of individuals with serious mental illnesses in correctional facilities are higher than other institutions within communities or the state. I would push back a little bit on that they are mental health institutions. They weren't designed to be so, and they have assumed the failings of our public health system with a no-reject policy at our jail and prison door. As such, they are responsible for providing a standard of care that is similar to the community, but we should make no mistake that jails and prisons are not psychiatric hospitals, weren't intended to be, don't provide the range of services that one would expect, and for people that don't pose a public safety risk, may not be the place that they should reside.
Is the, and I'm back to you, Fred Osher, is the fact that we're seeing increasing numbers of people with mental illness in jails and prisons, is that also a result of deinstitutionalization, the fact that mental hospitals, psychiatric hospitals have been closing over the last 50 years?
Yes, certainly from the height of our institutional population at close to 600,000, we have now dropped below 50,000 state beds. And without access to that level of care, some individuals end up in our jail and prison systems. The concept of deinstitutionalization was that the individuals would be able to live and thrive and recover in the community. Unfortunately, the dollars did not follow the policy, and so we find many individuals in need in communities without access to the effective treatment and supports that would maintain them in those communities.
Why didn't the money follow them?
Well, there's a variety of pressures on state budgets, as this show has documented over time.
Yep.
Nationally, we believe there's been about $5 billion that have been taken out of the public mental health system as states have confronted tough choices about funding. I think that we should, in this conversation, acknowledge the stigma that's ongoing related to mental illness. There is a variety of beliefs out there, but in general, people don't understand mental illness, don't understand it as a brain disease, and oftentimes then devalue the importance of treatment and supports in the community.
John Wetzel, let me go back to you, and I'm just curious about what happens. Let's say someone in one of Pennsylvania's either jails or prisons has been diagnosed with schizophrenia. What kind of services do they have access to?
Well, we have a broad range of service, actually. We're better resourced than the community. Now, some of this came out of a byproduct of getting sued by the Disability Rights Network and at the same time having a simultaneous investigation from the Civil Rights Division and Department of Justice, which, frankly, forced us to improve our system. But I just have to jump back for a second. When
sure.
you talk about the lack of funding for community infrastructure, let me weigh in on that because, you know, we're in the process now of looking at a state budget that passed out of the House that just is another step down the road in decimating the behavioral health safety net in the community. And where we pay for that is both financially and in the lives of individuals with mental illness and their families, by the way, is the fact that they default to the criminal justice system because we have huge gaps in our behavioral health safety net. And when someone falls through one of those gaps, the other end of that is a correctional facility. And this has been going on for quite some time. And we have to get to a place where we're making the right decision that when government has to intercede in somebody's life, and be that in the behavioral health system, in the criminal justice system, we need to focus on getting them back on track. And this short-term budgeting approach, which, you know, has been kind of the way we've done things for quite some time now, is just exacerbating this problem.
Well, let me try. No, go ahead. Go ahead. Finish your thought there.
I mean, just barely. Just in the past 3 years, we've had a 3% increase in the number of mentally ill individuals in our system. That's not heading in the right direction.
Let me turn to you, Bruce. And if someone in Philadelphia, let's say, is exhibiting some signs of severe mental illness and the cops are called, police are called to somehow intervene, what options do they have? I mean, what happens on the street?
Well, their options aren't many. There is crisis intervention training for the police department that helps them understand when someone might be diverted to a treatment facility rather than the prison. But the availability of treatment slots is not great, and certainly off hours it's essentially non-existent other than emergency rooms. So the great majority of the people that are picked up on the street talking to God on the corner end up in the jail.
Because there just isn't room in a treatment facility, a mental health facility?
Correct.
So they end up in jail. And then what? Then what happens to them?
It's a troublesome what happens. I mean, the care is provided.
I mean, what did they do wrong besides talking to God?
Often nothing. So When they come in there, we do primarily two things. One is self-injury prevention, because self-injury in prisons and jails is a major issue. It's frequent as compared to in the community. And then we do psychopharmacology. We do some groups, but not a lot of group therapy, and virtually no individual therapy. So as was said before, we don't match what used to be available in the community to people that had good insurance. So they'll come in, they'll be assessed very quickly within 4 hours, and if they have symptoms, then they're going to be seen by a mental health worker that day. And if they just have a history of receiving mental health services in the community, they'll be seen within the next couple of days. And then we start to do some discharge planning. But 40% of the people leave the prison in 2 weeks. You know, because it's a jail.
Right.
It's called a prison, but it's actually the county jail. 40% leave in 2 weeks. If they're not bailed out in the first 2 weeks, your average length of stay is 7.5 months. The average length of stay overall is 100 days, but it turns into 7.5 months. So if you come in and you're schizophrenic and you've burned bridges and your family won't come to bail you out, you're going to be with us for 7.5 months on average.
And then released after that, generally?
Generally, yeah, because most of these people are not charged with significant crimes.
Fredricia, let me turn back to you and even focus a little bit more on the Stepping Up initiative. So how will this, or is this initiative dealing with the problems that we heard described by both John Wetzel and Bruce Herdman?
Yeah, well, what we're having described is a phenomenon that is present nationally. It's an omnipresent tragedy that far too many people with serious mental illnesses are a part of our criminal justice settings, and that there has been a lot of work over the last decade and very effective small-scale programs that have demonstrated it's possible to divert individuals that don't require segregation back into the community and link them with care. The problem is that it hasn't been at a scale that's been sufficient to drive the numbers down. And while we've had a small downturn in many of our prison and jails nationally, the prevalence of people with mental illness continues to rise, regardless of how they got there. They got stuck there, and they have a difficulty time emerging. In response to that, the Council State Government's Justice Center, along with the National Association of Counties and the American Psychiatric Association Foundation, started the Stepping Up initiative. And we, in May of 2015, had a call to action to all 3,000-plus counties to step up and to make significant efforts to reduce the number of individuals with serious mental illnesses in their county facilities. In response to that, there have been over 350 counties in the country, over 13 in Pennsylvania, mm-hmm. that have passed resolutions dedicated to addressing in a systematic and structural way the problem that we're describing here today. And what we're really talking about is a paradigm shift in which we move beyond planning and pilots to an appreciation of the scope of the issue and the numbers of people with mental illness in our jails, and the development of scaled impact programs that produce measurable reductions in prevalence. And we are continuing to call on, and every week we have new counties that step up as a recognition that this is a problem that requires an effective and sustained response.
Well, we're going to take a very short break and then talk more about the needs of the people with mental illness who are incarcerated. Fred Osher, Bruce Herdman, and John Wetzel, our guests. And you can call or text our comment line, 267-405-2006. What do you think should be done about this problem? We'll be right back. This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moscowen. We are talking about the growing population of people with mental illness who are in prisons and jails in states across the country, of course, in Pennsylvania as well. There's a nationwide initiative to divert prisoners with mental health needs from jail to treatment. It's called the Stepping Up Initiative. Fred Osher, Director of Health Systems and Services Policy at the Council of State Governments Justice Center Initiatives, a group leading this Stepping Up Initiative, is with us, along with Bruce Herdman, Chief of Medical Operations for the Philadelphia Department of Prisons. And John Wetzel is with us as well, Secretary of Corrections for the state of Pennsylvania. And again, you can call or text our comment line, 267-405-2006. I see comments coming in, radiotimes@whyy.org. And you can tweet us at @WHYYRadioTimes. John Wetzel, let me go back to you, because I don't want our listeners to think that people who have mental illness are more likely to commit violent crime or even to be commit crimes compared to the rest of the population. Can you clarify that for us?
Yeah, I think you're exactly right. We don't see variance when we look at violent versus nonviolent, serious versus non-serious. The percentages essentially go across crimes as they are. So I don't think that mental illness is necessarily causal, or someone who's, let me say it more specifically, someone who's mentally ill is more likely to commit a crime than somebody else. But I think, you know, this initiative, and one of the things I think your listeners need to really understand about this initiative, it's very unique in that the state, both the Department of Human Services, Secretary Dallas, the Commission on Crime and Delinquency, and the Pennsylvania Department of Corrections actually put money up to bring Fred and his team into Dauphin County. So we partially funded this study, and we did it for a couple reasons. One, Dauphin County has both a very urban area and rural area, so we can, the lessons we learned there, we can scale all across the Commonwealth. But what we've not done, and trust me, every law enforcement, corrections, time I'm around my colleagues, this is our number one issue. But it's an issue, not a problem. And I say that to mean that we haven't quantified it. And so we talk about this, and when you hear these numbers, they're overwhelming. But if we really want to see a light at the end of the tunnel, we have to do a better job of quantifying specifically who's coming in our jail that both is suffering from mental illness, and of them, who's known by the behavioral health system, and does that information from the behavioral health system get to the jail folks? And then at the back end, are we reconnecting them to the behavioral health system on the outside? And the most exciting moment, when we kicked this off in Dauphin County, Secretary Ted Dallas from Department of Human Services said, listen, if we can find a way to identify specific gaps in my system that lead individuals to be incarcerated, we'll find a way to fill those gaps. And I think that's really, the solution is not in criminal justice alone, it's not in behavioral health alone, it's in jurisdictions looking at the individual and wrapping and responding to the needs of the individual, not looking through the lens of a specific department.
I mean, Fred, is that getting people to talk to each other, to share information, to see the same person and realize that there's something that they can do together?
Absolutely. Secretary Wetzel hit the nail on the head. This is an issue that requires collaborative strategies, and that it is really an opportunity for community providers to recognize the true importance of the jail and prison within their communities, to see that as a part of their communities, understanding that individuals that they work with in community today may be in prison tomorrow, same people coming back and forth. Our counties are spending $80 billion a year on the effort to segregate and incarcerate individuals. They put a lot of that into health dollars, and they see very little return on the investment at this point in time. So going back to Bruce's earlier point about the length of stay, the long lengths of stay of people with mental illness, they, in a series of studies that have been done, can be two times longer than those without mental illnesses for the same conditions, same charges, same sentences. And so we really are forced to take a look at the factors that account for that and ones that will mitigate that. Little periods of time in jail or prison can have a significant negative consequence on recovery. I do want to say I'm a psychiatrist by training.
Okay.
I'm not suggesting that people with and without mental illness not be held accountable for their actions. That absolutely needs to happen. At the same time, we need to identify that group of individuals that don't pose a risk to public safety and get them connected to care and provide them the supervision that allows them to move forward in their own recovery.
As the three of you were talking, I'm thinking, and this is less about our prison or jail system, but about just the families of people who get incarcerated. And certainly here in Philadelphia, there's a high rate of low-income individuals living in the city. And there's just a lot of stress and, I think, crisis in certainly some neighborhoods. How do families deal with something like this? I mean, the system is trying to deal with it, but this is a brother, a sister, a child.
Correct. We'll see and treat 30,000 individuals in a year, and we have 4,000 visitors a week that come to the jail. So there's close connection with many people, obviously, between the people that are incarcerated and otherwise. And this is a very economically and educationally disadvantaged population. So 80% of our patients come from federally designated underserved areas in the city, and their reading level is fourth grade.
Wow.
So
great needs.
Great needs, and the people have very few resources. When we last looked at the number of people coming through the front door with insurance, virtually no one had commercial insurance, and only 8% had medical assistance. So the resources for people are pretty limited, and it's hard to navigate the system.
Because it's so complicated.
It's very complicated, right.
Fred, are you concerned that this could be an argument to bring back mental institutions?
Well, that's an excellent question, Marty, and that we certainly can state that the pendulum has swung a little too far towards not having available beds within community. But the whole point of deinstitutionalization policy was a recognition that the science of treatment for mental illnesses had reached a state where individuals could be supported and treated within communities, so that wouldn't want the knee-jerk reflex to be build more state hospital beds and put people there when those that don't need that level of care can stay and be productive members of our society with the appropriate supports. I did, Marty, want to just go back to the question on families that
Sure.
you asked earlier, because these individuals and their families go through pain and suffering that might be unnecessary, and that we, a group I work with, asked Dear Abby to put a letter in her column about how many of you with family members with mental illness have had encounters with the criminal justice system. We received over 3,000 letters within a course of 3 months.
Wow.
Each of them would pull your heartstrings. And that these consequences of maybe unnecessarily bringing people into our criminal justice settings are profound, and family members suffer greatly. A core partner in our Stepping Up initiative is the National Alliance for Mental Illness. Those family members have recognized for a long time that their loved ones need better access to care, not quicker access to incarceration.
And that's Fred Osher from the Council of State Governments Justice Center Initiatives. Also with us, John Wetzel, Secretary of Corrections for Pennsylvania, and Bruce Herdman, Chief of Medical Operations for the Philadelphia Department of Prisons. And we are talking about the mental health needs of the incarcerated. And again, we've got comments coming in, radiotimes@whyy.org. You can tweet us at WHYY Radio Times. You can text and call our comment line, 267-405-2006. Let me put something else on the table. And John Wetzel, I'll start with you. The idea of mental health courts, is that a possible, if not solution, a way to address some of the needs we've been talking about?
Yeah, I think mental health courts are good. I think we just have to be realistic and honest about the capacity of things like that. You know, generally mental health courts only hit a very small portion, and so targeting is important. But I think oftentimes when we have these complicated issues, we're looking for a solution.
Right.
And I think the reality is the systems that function best have a myriad of solutions and options. And a tool chest of a combination of specialized supervision for this population. For instance, coupling a probation or parole officer with a mental health case manager. You talked about different specialty courts. The best specialty courts are ones that successful completion means get out of the criminal justice system without a criminal record. But then so much of these answers are in, again, just a good behavioral health system, other systems identifying someone who's going down a mental health path, and we're plugging people in to that system first. Bruce talked about CIT and the notion and the importance of first responders recognizing a situation that is a mental health crisis and not a criminal justice type crisis. So I think it's a myriad of things. Certainly I'm a big proponent of mental health courts. We know counties that have them send us a lower percentage of individuals with mental illness to the state prison, but we have to be realistic about capacity.
What do you think about mental health courts, Bruce?
Well, there is a mental health court in Philadelphia. Judge Sheila Wood Skipper manages that, and I believe you're talking about a few hundred people that can be handled through that one court in a year. We're releasing 5,000 people with seriously mental illness in a year.
Releasing them and releasing them to the community, to hopefully to families, to nothing.
Often it's nothing. Often it's not. We're releasing people without an arrangement being made for their care after release. It is something that we're hoping to address more effectively in the coming year, because with the governor's expansion of medical assistance, we're now able to begin enrolling people in medical assistance with the governor's help and activating that when they leave. prior to that, we would give people 5 days of medication and a prescription which they could not fill because they didn't have health insurance and they didn't have any money. And so if you release a schizophrenic person without the ability to stay on medications, you know the result is going to be quick and negative. So with the expansion of the Affordable Care Act, we have some hope.
Well, let me read a tweet from Carla, and I'll put this to you, Fred. She says, since the ACA forces mental health coverage, noticing the increases in treatment centers, but what happens if the Affordable Care Act is undone? And certainly the first foray that President Trump and the Republicans did at the ACA was to remove some of the things that we have been talking about, including an expansion of Medicaid. Fred, does that make this even more precarious?
Well, it does. And what we've seen with the 31 states, District of Columbia, that have expanded Medicaid under the Affordable Care Act is that the 9 out of 10 individuals with serious mental illness that didn't have a ticket to a health care provider now in those states with expansion can. And that's been a significant event in allowing for an expansion of treatment services within the community and, importantly, getting access to care that might mitigate the likelihood of returning to jail or prison in the future. I don't know what the tea leaves say about the future of the Affordable Care Act. At this point in time, it's still in place. More states at this point are considering expansion. It allows for a significant federal contribution to the overall provision of care, and it has been a positive development in terms of the issue that we're discussing today in those states that have chosen to expand, which includes the Commonwealth.
Let me play. Yeah, go ahead, John Wetzel.
If I could just hop in.
Sure.
The Affordable Health Care Act has been a game changer for both prison and jail reentry. The notion, and I'll give you a very specific example of a pilot we're doing with individuals suffering from the addiction to opioids leaving our prisons, where we can now give them Vivitrol, first shot before they get out, and 11 subsequent shots in the community. We sign them up for the Affordable Health Care Act, so they're covered for it, so it doesn't cost the state any money. And what we know is our six-month numbers show significant lower relapse rate. These things are significant, and it saves us money, but more importantly, it gives people an opportunity to get back on the right track. So I think that a full repeal of the Affordable Care Act, and I think one of the reasons it's difficult to answer is because we don't know what it's going to look like.
Sure.
And I get some sense from the fact that it wasn't able to be ramrodded through, that folks on both sides of the aisle understand the importance, and we've heard Republican governors, like Governor Kasich in particular, who said, look, we can't just throw the baby out of the bathwater. This is a critical piece of successful reentry and having a good behavioral health safety net on the front end.
Let me play someone that called our play a call that we got to our comment line, and this is from an anonymous father.
Hi, I'm a father of a child with severe mental illness who wound up in the justice system. And it takes collaborative family and community effort to keep a person who is incarcerated for nothing more than odd behaviors associated with a mental illness. It takes actors to intervene on behalf of a person who's been thrown asunder because of families not being able to handle the odd behaviors and the fallout from the confusion of mental illness. So it's a collaborative effort, and I hope this comment helps.
Absolutely, this comment helps, and I appreciate the fact that you called our comment line. And Fred Osher, I'll turn to you, and I think without getting into a lot of details, one can even hear in this father's voice just how complicated this stuff is and how even beyond our criminal justice system, we need to help families who have family members with mental illness.
Yeah, not just complicated, but I think the pain came through in his question as well. And it's just an unconscionable situation. Dorothea Dix in the 19th century had a crusade to get folks with mental illness out of our jails and led to the development of our state hospital system, that we have a situation so similar, if not worse, 200 years later is egregious, and that it demands a response and an immediate response. And it's really gratifying to see how many counties within the Commonwealth, the leadership within the Commonwealth that have said, you know, the status quo isn't acceptable. And for our family members, they know that better than any.
Well, I know, John Wetzel, to you, do you think that we view physical health problems differently than we view mental health problems?
Absolutely. We don't accuse somebody who is diabetic of contributing to that. And I think a big part of this narrative, and Fred talked about it earlier, is destigmatizing, you know, both mental illness and addiction. And frankly, one of the first things we did as we started to reform our mental health system was focus significant resources on training our staff. And one of those trainings, a mental health first aid course, which is an 8-hour course that is akin to CPR and first aid. It doesn't make you a doctor, but it gives you skills to recognize a medical emergency and manage it until a professional gets there. We sent all 15,000 of our staff through that in a year, and we did that, one, to make sure they could recognize mental illness, because that's critical. When you interpret a situation as someone being defiant as opposed to someone struggling in a mental health crisis, your response is significantly different. And so if you don't recognize those differences, that's how we get bad outcomes. But as important is the destigmatizing language. And another thing we've done to kind of destigmatize is we have over 600 certified peer specialists. That's inmates who are in recovery from mental illness, who are trained and paid to support and work with inmates who are suffering from mental illness. This program, which we started shortly after I started this job in 2011, we now have it at every prison, and they're a key part of our mental health team. And it really sends a message to staff and inmates alike that, look, just because you're mentally ill doesn't mean you can't contribute to the community.
We are talking about the mental health needs of the incarcerated, focusing largely on Pennsylvania, but obviously across the country as well. You can call or text our comment line, 267-405-2006. You can send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org, and you can tweet us at WHYY Radio Times. This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moscoane. Let me quickly reintroduce our three guests. Bruce Herdman is Chief of Medical Operations for the Philadelphia Department of Prisons. John Wetzel is Secretary of Corrections for Pennsylvania. And Fred Osher is with the Council of State Governments Justice Center Initiatives. And one of the initiatives they're involved in is called Stepping Up, and it's focusing on the nation's jails, reducing the number of mentally ill prisoners and getting them the appropriate care. There's something, Bruce, I want you to say off the air. We were talking about this during the break, looking at the number of, the recidivism rate for people with mental illness in Philadelphia.
It's much higher than the population that doesn't have a mental health illness. The average number of incarcerations for seriously mentally ill patients was 7.9.
Wow.
Time.
So it's a revolving door.
The prison represents a great opportunity to intervene and stabilize people, but if we don't connect to them and assure continuity of care, it's just they're going to deteriorate rapidly and come back.
And these are in many ways chronic conditions. So it's sort of like diabetes is a chronic condition, and it needs long-term care.
Exactly. There are no cures for these serious illnesses at the moment.
Right. Let me play. This is Steve, who called our comment line, and let's hear what he has to say.
My name is Steve. I'm calling from Philadelphia. I'm an attorney, somewhat familiar on a personal level as well as a professional level with regard to the problem that's under discussion. Let me say that from my experience, I have found that where the system breaks down almost totally is in the lack of serious and informed communication between the court system and the so-called social services network. There was a significant breakdown between those two issues, and what has happened repeatedly in cases with which I'm familiar is that the social services system cannot accommodate the individual who is about to be released from custody. And so you've got a lot of people who are homeless who are simply sent back out on the street without any benefit, without the food stamps, without the assistance payments, And so they're the ones who seem repeatedly to keep coming back into the system with these minor offenses, and you have a misdemeanor and a misdemeanor and a misdemeanor, and finally they become felonies, and the judges are not all mentally health equipped to deal with mental health cases, and they end up sending these people to prison. And that's where the system has broken down to the greatest extent.
And I think Steve described exactly what we're talking about, Fred Osher. He's saying that the court system, the social service system, at least from his experience, they don't talk to each other. They don't share information. And so someone does sort of the revolving door that Bruce Herdman was talking about.
No, he gave a very fair description of the problem that we're all confronting today. I think that information sharing is a misunderstood area in this conversation, and that frequently people use protections of confidentiality to preclude a necessary conversation that will both ensure better and safer communities and better outcomes for our individuals. And we've seen a number of communities around the country that have allowed both at the front end papers to be signed, consent to be given to allow for that effective communication, and a clarification of what is and what isn't covered under our health port information acts. I also, though, wanted to just comment on his point where we have a homeless crisis as well in our country nationally, about 7.2 million shortage of affordable housing units, homeless individuals, a very visible individual within our communities, frequently encountering law enforcement, as was cited, and that without access to appropriate housing, that homeless individual is at high risk for recidivism. And so we know that with our homeless population, about 25% of those individuals have serious mental illnesses, and that is a contributing factor to their overrepresentation in our jail and prison systems.
Bruce, you want to add anything to that, to what Fred just said?
30% of the people that are in the Philadelphia jail system are homeless, and they, as we said before, leave largely without connections to community services. But we are working with the Benny Philly system, the Benefit Data Trust, which has an automated system to enroll people in the kinds of services that Fred was just talking about. Right. We hope to be able to do that starting this coming year.
John Mitchell, let me go back to you. And you mentioned at the top of the hour the number of women with some kind of psychiatric either diagnosis or disorder who are also in our prison systems. You also mentioned the fact that many of them have been victims of some kind of trauma themselves. Are you saying that that leads to some kind of mental illness, or it just puts them at risk for behaviors that are probably not good for them?
Actually, I think it was Fred who talked about that, and I'll let him describe it as he's a psychiatrist.
Fred, you go ahead, Fred, resident psychiatrist. Yes, go ahead.
Sure. And that it is merely a combination. I mean, anyone that experiences trauma ends up carrying that burden with them, and it impacts the decision-making and relationship development going forward. It may be at such a degree that they actually meet our diagnostic criteria for a post-traumatic stress disorder, but whether that's true or not, an appreciation of the trauma that people experience prior to encountering law enforcement, prior to being booked and brought into our institutions, is an important awareness so that we can avoid re-traumatization in the booking and incarceration process, so that we can help those individuals understand the impact of trauma on their lives and connect them with treatments and supports that can mitigate the likelihood that that contributes to their arrest going forward. So no doubt that the high rates of trauma that all in our communities experience, particularly those with serious mental illness, contribute to the difficulties in establishing successful recovery in the community.
John Wetzel, I have an email for you from Kathleen. She says, can you talk more about the policy of solitary confinement for those who are experiencing psychosis? And I know your department had to address some of these issues.
Yeah, we've eliminated the use of restricted housing or solitary confinement for individuals with serious mental illness. Instead, we created a myriad of housing units that are secure, like a restricted housing would be, but increase the out-of-cell time and the interaction with others, and that was a key part of the lawsuit against us, that we were overusing restrictive housing or solitary confinement for individuals with mental illness, and the result of that was that they were more likely to self-harm and in some cases commit suicide, and that was 100% correct, which is why we modified the system. And I think in a big prison system like this, we also put lots of checks and balances in. So if somebody who we identify on our mental health roster gets a misconduct or gets in trouble, the first step is to have a mental health professional, if available, screen them to determine whether the behavior was related to their mental illness or it was a choice. But even still, if it was a choice, they go to these, we call them diversionary treatment units as opposed to a restrictive housing unit. So, yeah, we've made significant progress with both them, juveniles, and other vulnerable population, elderly and those kinds of things, where we've eliminated that. And also, at the same time, significantly reduced the use of it.
And Bruce, how about in Philadelphia? Is there ever a use of solitary confinement or some version of that?
Segregation occurs, and sometimes it's protective custody, where inmates will ask to be separated from people where they feel particularly vulnerable. And you'll see people who – that occurs with gang warfare, that occurs with the LGBT community, for example. The length of segregation for administrative purposes or punitive purposes is relatively short, usually less than 15 days. But we are working on a program for this coming year to try to increase the percentage of time out of cell to 10 hours with programming and 10 hours without programming for people that are in segregation. And that's true, by the way. We have a 64-bed licensed psychiatric hospital on the campus. It's just like any private hospital. Mm-hmm. And people who are in extreme distress are in their cells for a long period of time, which may be the only option for until they start to respond to pharmacotherapy.
Are people with mental illness who are incarcerated, are they likely to be targets by other prisoners, victimized by other prisoners?
Some of them, yes. Many of them operate very well in what we call general population, which is just the normal housing unit. But we have 300 step-down unit beds, which are for people that aren't sick enough to be in the mental hospital but are too vulnerable to be in general population. Mm-hmm. I did want to mention, too, that a comorbidity that's very important for this population is drug abuse. So in our case, about 75% of the people coming through the front door are abusing a drug, 56% marijuana, 21% benzodiazepines, amphetamines, PCP, smaller percentages for other drugs. And that does change people's behavior. We did 8,000 medical detoxifications last year out of 25,000 admissions.
8,000 out of 25?
Out of 25.
Like so a third.
It's a third. And that complicates the treatment of this illness tremendously.
Well, picking up on that, and if I can turn to you, Fred, whether the so-called war on drugs has resulted in the increased number of people with mental illness who are incarcerated.
Yeah, if we look, at our correctional population and its steep ascent and numbers that have grown over 30 years, it can be directly attributed to our policies on drugs. And that what we know is that individuals with serious mental illness are three times more likely to have a co-occurring substance use disorder than the general population, and that folks with a drug problem are four times more likely to have a serious mental illness. When you then sort of bring in people for possession, sales, trafficking, you are differentially bringing in a population that has higher rates of serious mental illness. And Bruce is absolutely right in saying that that presence and that three-quarters of folks in our jails with serious mental illness have a co-occurring disorder certainly complicates. It may or may not explain their entry into the system, right, but it complicates their exit from it. And the requirement of a comprehensive system that Secretary Wetzel was describing earlier, the need for integrated mental health and substance use care in the community, isn't as available as it needs to for the size of the population and its demands.
John Wetzel, I have a text for you from a Delaware listener. Can your guest say whether the mental illnesses of the inmates existed before they were incarcerated, or did the illness onset happen after incarceration? John?
The vast majority happened, the vast majority of our percentage
come in with a mental illness, although there would be a percentage that would be difficult for us to quantify, who develops those symptoms while they're incarcerated. And some of the things that would contribute to that are like age. Some disorders appear at different ages and those kinds of things. But I would say with pretty good confidence that the majority come with an illness, and we identify them at a booking as opposed to developing symptoms. But although, with that being said, you know, yep. we're a life means life state, so we've certainly seen an increase in dementia, and that is just because people are getting old in our system. You know, it's not 21% of our population is elderly, which is a
whole other thing.
High number.
It
yeah.
sure is. Let me read a text from Jeanette from Newtown Square, who says, as a person with mental health issues that lead me going to jail in Philadelphia, I can say that the mentally ill are mistreated in jail because of their status, something that needs to change. Would you agree with that, Bruce Herdman?
Well, I hope they're not mistreated in the jail, but I think the fact that we don't connect them effectively to treatment in the community is an improvement that we have to achieve.
And we have to do that. And Fred Osher, I know that this initiative wants to address all the things that we have been talking about during this hour. What's your definition of success?
Well, we have, within Stepping Up, a very simple metric that there are fewer people with mental illnesses in our jails tomorrow than there are today. And that I think it's important to keep our eye on that prize. So we can have small programs that impact a small number, but if we aren't looking at the entire picture, the whole pie, that we may not be able to design the comprehensive set of strategies that are necessary to get there. And that I wouldn't want listeners to leave this program without appreciating that there has been a shift and there has been movement in the direction of achieving that core metric, and that it is, having watched and been a part of this discussion for decades now, I feel like we are at a tipping point. We have state leaders like Secretary Wetzel, Secretary Dallas, that have really stepped up to say, you know, we are going to identify what we can do to make a difference, find the resources to do that, and ensure that that metric, fewer people tomorrow are in our jails and prisons than today, becomes a reality.
And John Wetzel, would that save money?
Yeah, it would. But more importantly, it would save lives and the lives of families and those kinds of things. I mean, money always spends better earlier on in the system than at the back end of the system, where it costs us, on average, $42,000 a year to incarcerate someone. Someone who's on medication and seriously mentally ill and needs special housing, that cost would be even higher. Not to mention that when somebody leaves our system, especially somebody who's mentally ill, and lower risk from a criminology or criminal risk standpoint, they come out more likely to commit another crime. So, you know, when you talk about people recidivating, some of that, we have to be honest, is the fact that going to prison is criminogenic. It creates crime, especially for lower risk individuals.
Well, on that note, John Wetzel, thank you for joining us today on Radio Times.
Thank you.
You're welcome. Secretary of Corrections for Pennsylvania, Fred Osher, thank you for joining us as well.
Thank you.
You're welcome. Director of Health Systems and Services Policy at the Council of State Governments Justice Center Initiatives, one of the groups behind this initiative called the Stepping Up Initiative. And Bruce Herdman, thank you for coming in and joining us on Radio Times as well.
My pleasure.
And he's Chief of Medical Operations for the Philadelphia Department of Prisons, also a member of WHYY's Community Advisory Board. Go to WHYY.org/Radio Times, and you can find out much more about this program. You can download a podcast of the show, find us on Facebook, and follow us on Twitter. Kevin Griffin, the engineer for today's edition of Radio Times, the show produced by Debbie Builder, John Ahrens, and Trinae Nuri. I'm Marty Moss-Cohen. Thank you so much for joining us.